From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
In the first 2 weeks of 2022, 14,000 new people have gotten their first vaccine dose every single day. That's around 100,000 newly vaccinated people, about the population of Peoria every week.
Madigan and his ilk, Governor Pritzker, they've done so much damage. But I promise you, we can overcome big challenges. It's what I'm good at.
Well, another Republican tosses his hat into the ring for governor and at least some positive news on the COVID front this week. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. Hannah Meisel is with us. She is NPR Illinois State House editor. And joining us today, we have Rick Pearson, the chief political reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And Rick, it's great to have you with us.
Always good to be with you guys.
So, Rick, I'll go to you first. We talked a bit on the show last week about Richard Irvin, Aurora's mayor, that he was likely to announce a bid for the Republican nomination for governor. Well, that happened. And a bit of a low-key announcement, but what did you think of his kickoff? What did you take away from it?
Well, a couple of things. He's being backed by some of the same political operatives that started out with Mark Kirk and his win for the U.S. Senate in 2010, and then shifted over to Bruce Rauner and Rauner's victory. A very slickly produced video debut, 3-minute bio of Irvin, which he's going to be, basically, that's going to be the basic thrust of the early part of this campaign, is trying to define himself before his opponents do, and declaring himself to be a Republican despite a voting history that shows him frequently pulling Democratic primary ballots, a defense attorney, a former prosecutor turned defense attorney, talking about adopting the tough on crime, but then in a run for mayor, talking about how passionately he believes in the Black Lives Matter movement. But in this video, it's the All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, don't defund the police kind of movement. It just seems very kind of scattershot of trying to figure out who Richard Irvin is, and can he ultimately prove himself enough of a Republican, particularly to the MAGA types, to get through a primary.
Yeah, Charlie, normally when people like this who don't have a lot of name ID across the state decide to get in the race, it seems like they tend to get out a lot earlier. In the old days when the primary was, say, in March, we might have seen them starting to make some headway in the summer months before the election. We're only talking, just a handful of months until the primary now, and that seems like a long time for him to go before people, to get people to know who he is.
Yeah, but he's going to have a ton of money behind him. He's going to have basically unlimited funding from Ken Griffin. And so he'll be saturating the airwaves, saturating social media with this message that kind of runs counter to the Richard Irvin of a year ago, who was praising Governor Pritzker, who was a firm believer in Black Lives Matter. Now he's an All Lives Matter guy, and he's fund the blue. And he attacks Pritzker for defunding police, those kinds of things, the Republican dog whistle stuff. And the timing is strange because of the way the primary got shifted, because we didn't have accurate data to do redistricting. And you wonder how much attention is going to be paid over the summer, the early part of the summer leading up to the primary, late spring. I'm just not sure. I don't believe he's had a news conference where he's actually taken questions from reporters yet. And maybe his handlers don't think he's ready for that. But it occurs to me that it would be very good for him to get out there and do that, because sooner or later, I would hope that he'll meet with reporters.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about his positions, Hannah, at this point, but like Charlie said, there's going to be a lot of money behind him. There's going to be a lot of money on the other side as well when it comes to the Democrats, and they're going to be hammering on him all the way through this primary. Governor J.B. Pritzker has made that clear. He's not afraid to spend money on his own reelection campaign.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, we saw the contest in 2018. He spent, I want to say, $171.5 million of his own money. It was 4 years ago. You know, he has signaled that he is not afraid to spend even more on Friday evening, last Friday evening. You know, he dumped another $90 million into his campaign fund. You know, of course, Ken Griffin, as we've talked about before, reportedly has vowed to spend upwards of $300 million on this campaign cycle. Of course, not all of that necessarily going into the governor's race, but it's going to be a stupidly, mind-numbingly expensive campaign cycle. But yeah, I mean, this is going back to what Rick said about, you know, it's the same campaign operatives that brought us Bruce Rauner 2014, Mark Kirk 2010. You know, these are folks who have kind of a vested interest in keeping the Illinois Republican Party kind of how it's been, a party that is more business focused than anything. Of course, you do have this theme of crime that, you know, they can say, they can kind of parlay into a, well, you know, if you have rampant crime, then businesses are gonna pack up and not invest in the state, et cetera, et cetera. But they have this vested interest in not following the tide of the National Republican Party, not going full Trump. And it's going to be really interesting to watch him it play out because, of course, you know, Irvin would first have to get through a primary with all of these other, you know, long declared Republicans, with the exception of Jesse Sullivan, because we've seen some very interesting opposition research about what he, you know, did, you know, as recently as 15 years ago, founded a progressive magazine when he was in college. You know, the rest of the three long declared Republican candidates are definitely dyed in the wool GOP folks to varying degrees of, you know, extreme right wing positions. And, you know, they don't have nearly the campaign cash as Irvin will have with the Griffins backing. But yeah, and then we also have, you know, the messaging that we're already beginning to see, you know, how will Democrats try to kind of sabotage the primary? We've already seen a video from the Democratic Governors Association, you know, dredge up pretty recent footage of Richard Irvin praising Governor Pritzker. And they're trying to make the point that, like, why would you want another, you know, for Republican voters, why would you want this guy? And to, there is no distinction between the two of them. And yeah, I, you know, it's going to be a very, 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 very long primary season and somehow an even longer general election season until we get to November 8th.
Well, Rick, we
and it strikes me too that the message so far from this slate sounds impressive, but not if you compare it to the facts. And you wonder, is there hope that people are so gullible that they won't go beyond this rhetoric about the Mike Madigan machine? I mean, just as an example, the guy who's running for Secretary of State, John Millhiser, says he will make sure we never go back to the history of corruption through which that office has been a crucible. And I'm thinking to myself, well, Secretary of State, corruption, Jesse White's had it for what? Oh, Lord, it seems like forever. He's not really had any scandal. Who was the last guy who had scandal? Secretary? Oh, a guy named George Ryan. Wait a second. He was a Republican. Or maybe he was a Madigan puppet in disguise. Maybe that's it. And there, it's all about Madigan. The woman who's who's running for comptroller talks about the Madigan machine and their career politicians. We'll root out the corruption that's become a way of life for Madigan machine politicians. And I'm not sure how well that's going to play if people say, okay, now what specifically are your proposals. How are you going to address this? Urban at one point talked about how he was going to get rid of these prosecutors who are soft on crime. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not sure you can do that. Their prosecutors are generally elected locally, and generally the people who prosecute criminal offenses are U.S. attorneys and state's attorneys in the 102 counties. It's not something that the attorney general, for example, gets involved in.
But
so,
Charlie, I was going to say though.
I was going to say that. So the question is, how closely are voters going to be examining these guys and women, and going beyond just the rhetoric and the campaign ads they're going to see, to figure out, well, where does this person really stand on these key issues?
But Charlie, Democrats have used this too. I mean, let's look back to George Ryan and Judy Bartapinka being tied to him. And certainly we've seen that in the past with, it's played well.
And I'm not saying that this has never occurred before. Yeah, usually the party that's on the out can throw all this stuff out there. The party that's on the in has a record, and they have to defend their record.
Well, Colin, go ahead, Rick.
I'm just saying, if you want to attack the party on the in, I think you should be more accurate than what this stuff looks like so far.
I mean, you're seeing the Democrats trying, and this is they're going to be their playbook, is anything about Richard Ervin is going to be that this is Bruce Rauner 2.0. And while, you know, Ervin, who we don't know what his feelings are about Donald Trump, or whether the election was stolen or that kind of thing, it becomes Rauner becomes kind of the Illinois Trump for Democrats. And, you know, will that linkage carry over to any great effect? You know, maybe in a general election, but I mean, certainly, you know, for a Republican primary to have Madigan as the foil guy, you know, that's just the established playbook, and that's never going to change. I mean, that'll probably be that way for the next 30 years, regardless of how Madigan's fate ends up. But when it comes to the general election, I think, you know, there comes the question of, so what are you going to do for me? You know, what is it exactly you're proposing to do here? What policies do you have? And I don't think we're going to see, quite frankly, much of that in the Republican Party primary. I think it's going to be more about a purity and loyalty kind of test that comes down to, and eventually to involve the Trump factor.
Well, Rick, we know that money doesn't always win, but it certainly helps a lot. Now, if Ervin has all the money we think he's going to have in this race, that should help him in the primary. But is there someone else in that primary, from what you've seen so far, who could possibly give him a pretty strong run and possibly pull it out?
Well, I mean, I think Democrats would love to see Darren Bailey, the state senator from Xenia, be the candidate. And, you know, Bailey being on kind of the extreme right with the, you know, even talking about trying to separate Chicago from the rest of the state and co-sponsoring legislation about that. I think Democrats would love to see Darren Bailey do it. But he does have a substantial grassroots following, and that plays well in the rural downstate areas. I mean, to me, the question about Ervin and picking a suburban mayor in an area that is going through a very rapid demographic shift from once being staunch Republican to being very purple these days, trying to grab back some of those disaffected independents and maybe suburban women who are always a swing factor in that area. I don't know if there's the counterbalance of the votes there to take into account downstate and the shifting voting patterns in Republican primaries.
Bailey is maybe the most prominent of the downstate Republicans. But what happens if, as it appears now, there's going to be Ervin from Aurora, and there's going to be on the ballot, there's going to be who? Bailey, Schlimp, Sullivan? Who am I missing?
Well, don't. And
from downstate. Are they going to split the downstate vote?
Well, I mean, when you look at the finances and stuff, you've got Schimpf doesn't have any cash. You've got, you know, Bailey does have some cash. You've got Sullivan, but Sullivan really hasn't shown what he is or who he is. And I mean, a very bad debut. I also don't want to forget Gary Rabine, who's the businessman from the Northwest suburbs here of Chicago, who is definitely angling for a Trump endorsement in this and does have connections with Trump. He hosted a fundraiser at the Bow Valley Country Club that he's part owner of that featured Don Jr. and his girlfriend. And he's also connected with Turning Point USA, very conservative group that is pushing the big lie. And he's also part of the business group that successfully won in the Supreme Court over the mandate for employers, the vaccine mandate for employers that Biden was seeking to impose. So, I mean, I do think there's an unknown here about a Trump factor, and that we still need to see how that presents itself.
Well, Hannah, there's certainly some issues out there that Republicans seem to be going for here in the upcoming governor's race across the state. And one of those is the issue of crime. We have seen retail thefts, you know, getting a lot of attention in the Chicago area, especially. It seems like the Democrats might be a little concerned that could be an area that Republicans might be targeting that also might be effective.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just on a human level, no one wants to feel unsafe in their homes, in their areas. And crime is not just a Chicago issue. Crime is not just an issue, you know, as much as, you know, some folks might try to make that into reality. It's no, I mean, we're seeing upticks in crime all over the place. And, you know, even when you try to tamp that with statistics, it kind of doesn't matter, because when people feel unsafe, then perception eventually will become reality. So yeah, I mean, Democrats in Democrat areas are, you know, affected by this too. And so you have Republicans who have been, you know, for months now trying to coalesce around this, this messaging and, you know, put the, you know, kind of hand this responsibility to Democrats, especially because, you know, in early January of 2021 passed a massive criminal justice reform bill that included a lot of things, which, of course, as we've said on the show before, has yet to go into effect. It's another one of those things where, again, perception becomes reality. And so when you have police unions pushing this message that, you know, cops don't feel supported and that's why they're quitting the force in droves, you know, perception becomes reality. And so you have House Speaker Chris Welch in a round of interviews last week saying that, yeah, we will do an anti-crime legislative package this spring. No indication yet of what that might entail. He was very vague on details. But he and his caucus and the Senate Democratic caucus too, they're going to have to toe the line between defending what they passed last year and you know, what they would want in this anti-crime legislative package. And yeah, these are two separate things. These are two separate types of legislation, but to the general public, and, you know, maybe this is a failure of journalism, to be honest, I don't know that the general public would, you know, see the nuance between the two. And of course, Republicans have a vested interest in there not being any nuance between the two.
Yeah, Charlie,
and this is...
Oh, go ahead, Rich, go ahead.
Well, and going back to when I mentioned that demographic of suburban women, this is a, you know, crime is a very key factor here when you look at, you know, there tend to be socially moderate, fiscal conservative, but also very much about pro-schools, pretty much pro-choice, but also safety of their homes. And you know, there's a reason that they're in the suburbs. A lot of them stem from, you know, having moved out of Chicago out of crime fears. And don't forget, there's also the ever-present issue of race here too, that Republicans are trying to exploit with the crime issue. That's, I think, only going to deepen and intensify as this issue goes further into polarization. But when you mentioned about Welch, he knows he's got to do something. But yeah, he's not getting pinned down on any specifics except to talk about carjacking and organized retail theft. And you've got those suburbs where they've swung Democratic, and now you've got Democratic legislative incumbents. They're feeling the heat from those constituents about, you've got to do something. I mean, you've got, it's not just Chicago, it's out in the suburban shopping malls where you're seeing these smash and grab organized crime activities going on at the local mall.
Yeah, Charlie, I wanted to, before we move on, get your thoughts on this. Is this a strategy that could work for Republicans?
I think it could, for the reasons that Rick said, that this is an issue that resonates in the suburbs where people are anti-Trump, at least based on what the voting showed in the last election, but they're very concerned about public safety. And again, it goes back, are people going to be nuanced? Or are they just going to react as the Republicans want them to, just emotionally? One of the arguments that's being made is that, well, we're doing away with cash bail. And I'm thinking, that doesn't happen for another year. So how could these burgeoning instances of crime, how could that have to do with the fact that of the cash bail being eliminated a year from now? Are the criminals thinking that far ahead, figuring, well, I won't get caught for another year, and then I'll be able to get out of jail? I mean, you got to look at this stuff kind of rationally. The Civic Federation in Chicago, which is hardly a left-leaning liberal think tank, did an analysis on their blog a couple of days ago, talking about what the data shows on the bail reform in Cook County. And they basically concluded that removing money as a factor in pre-trial release decisions is supported by the research, best practices, and national principles on bail. They also cited a study done by researchers at Loyola University that found, while the Cook County reforms led to an increase in the number of people released from bond court, they did not lead to any changes in the Chicago crime rates. And the same was true in other jurisdictions in New Jersey, New York City, Philadelphia, they cited. So in my mind, it's a real nuanced type of issue. If one goes below just the social media rants, it's a lot more complicated than just saying, well, we have to repeal this legislation that was passed a year ago.
Let me save just a moment here at the end. Hannah, give us a quick update. Is there some light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to Omicron? What are we seeing with the numbers?
It does look as if we are, we've been past the peak, and we've seen hospitalizations for COVID decline precipitously in the last week or so, which is very encouraging. But of course, this doesn't mean that we are completely out of the woods yet. Hospitals were very, 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 very stressed at the peak, and they continue to be very stressed right now. Who knows when we might, be at the level that we were, I don't know, in October, November, before this variant came ashore. Maybe we won't get back to those low numbers because Omicron is still the dominant variant in the United States and really all over, and it's still so much more contagious. It's very encouraging, but we're not quite there yet. However, we also have a lawsuit that is pending a decision, and it's a lawsuit filed by our guy, Tom DeVore, who is Darren Bailey's lawyer, who kind of launched him to, they launched each other to fame, honestly, in fighting the governor's COVID restrictions. And we have this lawsuit that if it went DeVore's way, masks would not be worn in schools anymore. Schools are kind of walking on eggshells trying to figure out how to proceed if the decision went DeVore's way.
Okay, time now for our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's go to you first.
Well, there's an interesting case before the Illinois Supreme Court, and the oral arguments on it were this week. And the question is, should Illinois politicians who are under criminal investigation be allowed to use their campaign funds to pay for lawyers to help beat the charges? Or is this something that goes beyond what campaign funds can be used for? And this stems out of a complaint filed against Danny Solis, who is a Chicago politician, and he was wired up for conversations with Ed Burke and others. And he used his campaign funds, something like $220,000, to help pay for his lawyers. And one of his rivals, Alderman Brian Sancho Lopez, challenged it. The State Board of Elections said, no, that's a legitimate use. And Sancho Lopez's argument is, hey, campaign funds are supposed to help you get elected and carry out your official duties. Being a crook is not part of your official duties.
Okay. And Rick?
Just quickly out of Chicago, we're all focused on the 2022 elections, but 2023 is the mayoral elections, as well as the city council, which is still trying to figure out a new map. But Lori Lightfoot, who is running for re-election, we just had campaign finance reports filed for the last quarter of last year. She raised $538,000, which is not a lot of money, even despite a big campaign fundraising swing to California during that period. Normally, you have mayors stockpiling money and using it as a kind of a show of strength and as a warning for other challengers. But with Lightfoot's numbers not very good, her fundraising sure doesn't tell anybody to get out of the race.
Okay. Hannah.
Quarterly campaign finance reports were due this week, and we had a couple of fun facts. Former Governor Bruce Rauner finally shut down his campaign committee, leaving $40,000 unpaid in debt to a suburban consulting firm. And we had a lot of folks making jokes about Bruce Rauner leaving the state high and dry, as he is now a full-time resident, or mostly a resident of Florida. And then also, Mike Madigan, obviously ousted from power about a year ago, his 13th Ward Democratic Organization campaign committee is still reporting a bunch of campaign cash. And last quarter, they pulled in about $180,000 from unions, because of course.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org, through the NPR One app, or iTunes. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.